We are continuing our journey through the life of Jesus. And we've been doing this for months now. We started back in December, heading into the Christmas story, and we're jumping into we just spent 7 weeks talking about the Sermon on the Mount, which of course is so full of great content. And then we took a week off for Easter. What a great day that was. And then today we're gonna get back into the story. We're continuing our journey, and today we're gonna see Jesus call another disciple to follow him. We've seen six of them already. There's only seven stories of disciples that Jesus called that we know how he called them. The rest, they just kind of, they're there one day. So we're gonna see the last of those stories today. It's a man named Matthew. Now I'm gonna tell you what we're gonna do. We're gonna look at the story of Jesus calling Matthew. Is told in three different books. It's told in the book of Matthew, the book of Mark, and the book of Luke. And actually, Mark and Luke tell the story using his Jewish name, which is Levi. So he had a Hebrew name and a Greek name. And he wrote his own account in the Gospel of Matthew. He wrote his own account and he went with his name Matthew. So we're going to do the same. But we're going to look at these three accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, telling the same story. And we're going to do something a little bit. We're going to mash them together. Because every one of them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, each tell a different detail that I don't want to overlook by just picking one of them. So we're just going to kind of jump from one to the other. Like if you're following along on the screen, we'll be in Mark in one screen. The next screen will be in Luke. Then we'll be in Matthew. We're going to bounce back and forth, which is tricky if you're trying to follow along in your own Bible. And I acknowledge that. But go home and read the stories yourself on your own time so you don't miss the sermon, trying to keep up. They're found in Matthew 9, Mark 2, Luke 5. You can read them for yourself. But today, just join the journey. And I also want to say this to you before I get started. There are three different character groups in today's story. There's Jesus himself doing some things. There's Matthew and Matthew's crowd we're going to meet. And then there's the religious people who don't like what's happening. And I want all of us to do ourselves a favor, and I want us to relate to all three groups today. We're very good at watching TV shows or movies or reading stories and relating to one character primarily. You know, we call them the protagonist. They might be a flawed protagonist, but we can relate to them. And I want us to do better than that because that kind of puts us in a certain perspective only, and it makes us filter how we see the story and what we're cheering for. It's kind of what we do with our sports teams, you know. We have our favorite sports teams, depending on where we were born or lived or raised or whatever, you know, then everything's through that lens and all the systems, the refs are against my team. And we always have a certain outcome we expect and how we see how things ought to go. But I want us to be a little bit more broad today in the story. I want us to see the story through Matthew's lens and through the lens of Matthew's people so it can encourage you today. I want us to see the story through the lens of the religious leaders around them so it can convict us today. We got to relate to all sides of the story. And I want us to look at the lens of Jesus so that we can be inspired today. So let's just try to do that as we go through. The story begins today for us in Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. It says, as Jesus was walking along, he saw a man named Matthew sitting at his tax collector's booth. Now, here's the first big moment of challenge. Matthew is a tax collector, and nobody liked the tax collectors in Jewish culture or anybody's, really. And I know that not that we're fans of taxes today sometimes, right? I'm sure that everyone's like, oh, I love paying my taxes. It's so fun. I know I had to write a bigger than I wanted to check out a couple weeks ago in April, so grr. But anyhow, that's just how it goes. That's life. But this is different. Because people weren't collecting taxes just for their own country. They were collecting taxes to pay the Roman government. Because Rome ruled over all these other nations and expected those vassal states to pay their taxes. Which means that the countries that they collected taxes from had to extort that money from their people, and they could not even use it to improve their own infrastructure. They had to send it to Rome. So it kept the nations kind of weak and kept Rome stronger to increase their military presence and increase their power. And everyone resented it, but what could you do? What could you do? So you just dealt with it. And in the story that we read, what we find is that the Jewish people especially hated tax collectors. And I'll tell you why. while no nation liked them, to the Hebrew, to the Jewish people, their angst was spiritual as well as national, spiritual as well as political. Because you see, they were God's chosen people, right? I mean, 2,000 years earlier, God came to their ancestor Abraham and said he'd make a great nation out of them, and their descendants would bless all the nations of the earth. 1,500 years ago, God brought them out of slavery in Egypt to this land, and he gave them a government that was theocratic in nature, which means God, the people who ran the nation were sort of spiritual leaders as well, and the Levites and priests. And so it was a very blended system of spiritualism and nationalism that was unique. And so for them, foreign oppression was not just an inconvenience or unliked. It was people were standing between them and God's will. And so they felt, and boy, aren't we always extra indignant when we believe we can spiritualize our frustrations and anger? Then it becomes righteous indignation. And so they're really upset about Rome. And so therefore, those who collected taxes for Rome, oh, they were the worst. Because you're helping the system. You're facilitating the other side of the aisle, so to speak. You're facilitating things that God's not for, and I can't be a part of that. And so there's a lot of angst towards tax collectors. And I don't think we can get, I'm trying to set this up, because I don't think we can really relate other than to hear that and say, oh, that makes sense. But we don't feel that angst today in our own hearts. The best we could do in our current culture is to ask ourselves, what are the groups of people that we in a modern day Western American church, what are the groups of people that we have a trouble accepting and liking? What are the kinds of people that we think we want to keep at arm's length and push to the outside? That's the crowd that would be our version of the tax collectors of that day. What's the group of people that you say, well, I just don't like, you know, they shouldn't be part of the number of us, you know? You say, well, what are you referring to, Arlen? Whatever you imagine, I'm probably referring to that. Just fill in the blank. Because that's their angst. That's where their struggle point was. And so Jesus comes along to Matthew, who probably has seen Jesus around the area doing good things, has seen Jesus at work, and had heard the stories, and he's curious, but Jesus is not gonna, he's a religious man, he'll have nothing to do with Matthew. But he walks past, and he says to Matthew, he says, follow me and be my disciple. Wait a minute, no. You don't say that to Matthew. You don't tell Matthew to come along and join the entourage. He is not fit to join the entourage. He does not belong hanging out with us. He's a tax collector. I mean, Jesus, listen, here's what you need to do, Jesus. Tell him to first, reform himself, you know, change his ways, denounce his old life, confess and repent and show proof that he has sufficiently repented, and then he can reapply and join the crowd. But not like this. And Jesus, no. That's how he called all of his disciples. Just follow me. Yeah, but what about all the things that are, if you follow me, it'll work out in time. Just follow me. Let's go. And so he invited them. And all the religious people, as we're going to see, that's hard. But even for the disciples, that would have been hard. And what does Matthew do? It says Matthew got up and followed him. Now, that's a simple verse. I spent a lot of time setting up the tension so we would appreciate it. But I want us to watch a clip from the TV series, The Chosen. As I've told you before, The Chosen has allowed churches like ours to get permission to show certain clips on certain Sundays, as long as we jump through the right procedures. And we got permission to show a clip from their show. It's a phenomenal show where Jesus calls Matthew. And I want you to see how they portray it. If you've not watched The Chosen before, in the show, Matthew is portrayed as a brilliant mind, a brilliant, brilliant minded person with numbers and math and names and systems, but he's very awkward socially. He's on the spectrum somewhere, we would say. Just very awkward here, but very, very good with numbers. He knows his lane, but the awkwardness makes him peculiar. And he had seen Jesus in the show. He had already been around due to his job and certain things he was investigating. He had watched Jesus in action, and he was intrigued and asking questions, but he was struggling. His family rejected him, his people rejected him, and he's just trying to get by. And it's a great show, and I can't set up all that went into this moment for you. But for 3 minutes, let's watch how they portray the calling of Jesus, of Matthew by Jesus. Cliff, I love that line that Jesus uses when he says, get used to different. Isn't that the story of the whole gospel? Jesus comes pouring in and says, y'all thought you had a system of how we do God? Get used to different. And a lot of the most religious people had a hard time with that. I think we all still do because we have an idea of what we expect it to look like. And Jesus was challenging thinking. And he's not done yet. But what he's saying in this moment by calling Matthew is what he's trying to get across is a big idea about what it looks like and what it means to be able to follow Jesus. Let me make this statement to you. Being a sinner doesn't disqualify you from following Jesus. Actually, it's a prerequisite, right? You know who didn't follow Jesus? You know who did not follow Jesus? People who felt they were perfect. They weren't sinners. Why did I follow him? I got it all figured out, right? Remember the Sermon on the Mount? We spent several weeks talking about it, how that in that sermon, Jesus would say to people, you think you're better than others. You think that God grades on a curve and you're near the top and you're okay and you got systems for the rest and you're all set, but you're not because God's standard is perfect. And he does not grade on a curve. He wants you to be exactly this, and here's what he calls you to. And by the end of the Sermon on the Mount, everyone's like, holy cow, my security is shot, you know? I'm not okay, which is the whole point, because self-righteous people don't need God. In fact, the Sermon on the Mount began by Jesus saying, God blesses those who realize their need for him. The kingdom of heaven is theirs. And so being a sinner doesn't disqualify you from following Jesus. It's actually a prerequisite. And so just come along and be a part. Well, the story continues in Matthew 9, verse 10. It says later, I don't know how much later, doesn't say how much, but later, Matthew invited Jesus and his disciples to his home as dinner guests, along with many tax collectors and other disreputable sinners. Now, I wanted to highlight that last statement because that's a mouthful. Matthew's like, hey, I'm going to have a party. Jesus is coming over, the disciples are coming over, and my friends are coming. Who are his friends? Well, tax collectors, as I said earlier, was a special kind. To the people who would be religious enough to call people sinners, they would call certain groups of people certain kinds of sinners. And tax collectors had their own special category. Tax collectors were a group of disreputable sinners. That's why it says, and other such sinners. They made their own category because that's how bad they were. You're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong. I can't stomach that. And of course, Matthew invited tax collectors over. That was his people. Those were his professional connections, right? Tax collectors. They were all in the same work. They were all equally shunned and disliked by their countrymen. They all went to the same Roman tax seminars every year. You know, the tax seminars to get the updated tax code. Rome's new tax code for the new year. Collect your taxes or die. Same as last year, okay. And so they would go collect taxes. And that makes sense that he would invite tax collectors to his party. But it says he also brought not just tax collectors, but other disreputable sinners. Other kinds of people that you would put in a category saying, oh no, we don't go there. And they also, now how would Matthew invite these groups? How does he even know these other kinds of sinful people? And you know why? You know how he knows them, don't you? It's because marginalized people tend to find other marginalized people because they find a connection point, because they all have something in common. They're outsiders. They're unwanted. They're condemned. And so they're all in the same arena. And Matthew says, come on over, man. They're my friends. Jesus comes over and he's going to eat with them. And that bothers some people. It's going to bother some people in the story. It could bother us if we let it. Like, why would Jesus eat? Like, I can understand if he just shows up one time for a quick dine and dash, you know? He's going to show up. He'll be like, I'll tell you what, I'll show up, grab a handful of popcorn shrimp, and then get out of there. But what will I wear, you know? So he's got to figure all this stuff out. But here's Jesus showing up, not just to dine and dash, but to build a relationship. I mean, table fellowship was a big deal in that culture. You don't eat with certain people. And it didn't stop there. Because according to Mark chapter 2, in the same story, Mark adds this detail. He says, there were many people of this kind among Jesus' followers. In other words, what's this kind? Well, this kind is the tax collectors and the other disreputable sinners. Many people of that kind were among Jesus's entourage, the ones who said, we want to go wherever he goes. We want to see what he's doing. We're along for the ride. Can we be with you? Yes, come along. He had a lot more than 12. We see later he had many people just followed him and were with him and part of his group, including many people in these categories. And I love that because it reminds me of a statement I heard about 12 years ago, and I've loved it and used it ever since. It goes like this. People who were nothing like Jesus liked Jesus, and Jesus liked people who were nothing like him. That's pretty cool. We struggle with that, don't we? We struggle to like people who are nothing like us. I mean, you know, if you're like me, I'm okay, but if you view how we do church or faith differently than me, I just don't know if I like you. If you view politics or vote differently than I think you should, I don't know if I like you. If you have a different lifestyle or raise your family, different family dynamic than I have, I don't know if I like that. If you have different sports teams, I don't know if I like that, you know? I mean, are you a Sox fan? God have mercy on you. You know, we struggle. I'm just kidding, Sox fans. You need to be sympathized with, not beat down right now. But anyhow, so we struggle, right? To like people that we're not like, that we don't relate to in some way. And because we struggle to do that, they struggle to like us back for that very reason. But people who are nothing like Jesus liked Jesus. And Jesus liked people who are nothing like him. That encourages me. You know what that means? That means Jesus would, I want to say this to you. If Jesus was here today, he'd like you. I know some of you believe that. Of course he would. We'll talk about you in a minute here. But for many of us, we struggle to believe that. We're thinking, no, look, I could come to church and fake it in front of all of you, but if Jesus showed up, I would just want to duck out, hang my head, because if you only knew me, like he would know me, he'd like you. He'd want to sit down and have a meal with you. He'd want to welcome you to the team. He'd say, come along. And we struggle to believe that, but it's true. He likes sinners like me. You say, well, Arlen, of course, sinners like you, you're a sinner, but you're a pastor. No, I'm a disreputable sinner to somebody. Did you know that? Think about this. I'm going to just tell you a little insight into my world. There are numbers of people out there who have the worst opinion of pastors because they don't lead the way they think they should lead. It's not that they did anything immoral or bad. That's another monster. But the pastors who just don't teach the way they think they should or represent the right ideas, they're the worst. I mean, they would rather you be an unbeliever than a pastor that doesn't lead the way they think they should lead. I mean, dangerous. So, to some people, I'm very disreputable. And I can condemn myself, and you can condemn yourself. It's easy to justify our own self-doubt and a lack of self-worth. But I got news for you. If Jesus was here, he'd like you. He'd like me. He'd say, hey, I'm glad that I'm here for you. Let's do this together, right? That's how it goes. That encourages me and hopefully can encourage you. So there we are. It's a happy story. Everyone likes everybody. We can party and go home. Except for that's not how it ends. In verse 16 of Mark 2, it says, but when the teachers of religious law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with tax collectors and other sinners, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with such scum? These are the ones who knew the scriptures of their day, we call the Old Testament. They knew all the scriptures. They read the scriptures. They memorized the scriptures. They studied the scriptures. They taught the scriptures, right? They ran the temple. They led the synagogues. They were the God crowd that everyone else would say, well, if anyone's probably in the God circle, it's those religious people. Whether I like them or not, they're definitely that. That's their team. Those people said to Jesus and to his disciples, why is he eating with such scum? In fact, I like how Luke tells this part of the story. In Luke 5, verse 30, it says, but the Pharisees and the teachers of religious law complained bitterly to Jesus' disciples. Why do you eat and drink with such scum? They said. Now, why would they complain to Jesus' disciples and not complain to Jesus? I think we know the answer, don't we? Because when they've tried to argue with Jesus before, and he always had the perfect answer to shut them up. They've even gotten around Jesus before and thought bad thoughts about him, and he would know their thoughts and call it out and put them in their place anyhow. Like, there's no fixing Jesus, okay? He's gonna be what he's gonna be. His miracles are gonna make him popular with the simple masses. But if you can't tear down Jesus, they were gonna do what people do today. You know what people do today over religion or politics or anything on all sides of the aisle? Is if you can't tear someone down that you wanna destroy, you try to tear down their support network so that no one's left standing with them, so that they're isolated. So if they can tear his disciples down and pull them away, then they can isolate Jesus. So they complain to the disciples and they say, why are you doing this? Why are you eating with such scum? Why are you hanging with these kinds of people? You should know better. Get away from them. Get away from Jesus. They're upset. But look what Jesus says in return. In Matthew 9, verse 12, says, when Jesus heard this, he said, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. Now, is Jesus saying out loud that those religious people are very healthy and everyone else is sick? Is he saying, oh, you religious people, you are so healthy when you call other people scum? That's a healthy thing to do right there. I mean, you're healthy and they're sick. No. What Jesus is doing is something that he always did, that we saw him do it during the Sermon on the Mount, in that part where he taught us not to judge other people. Is he would use this approach where he would say, okay, before I correct your thinking, let me come alongside of you and argue from your vantage point. So you think you're healthy? Then you don't need me. You know, if you're healthy, you don't go to the doctor. Sick people do. If you think you're spiritually healthy, you don't need the me, because you're already spiritually healthy. You got it all figured out, don't you? Again. But you know who you think needs me? You think that sick people, spiritually sick people, need God, and yet you're mad at me for trying to connect with them? Do you see how illogical that is? Do you see your own? But they, of course they don't. And because they're busy saying, yeah, but you can't get around those kinds of people. You know what? A lot of us are insecure about getting condemned, not just for what we do, but if we're a religious person, you get worried about being condemned for who you hang around. Jesus didn't seem to mind. In fact, another statement I love, it's not mine also, but it's just a good one. It goes like this: if Jesus was worried about guilt by association, he would have stayed in heaven, right? It's a lot safer. You know, you come down there, you come down to this world and you get down there with the ickies and the sickies, things can happen, you know? So just stay in heaven, right? But he wasn't worried about that. He says, I don't care if somebody, some pious, very sure they are right with God, religious person thinks I'm doing a terrible thing. I don't care. I'm here to do something that whether they approve or not. And he didn't worry about guilt by association. Otherwise, he wouldn't have come. So Jesus turns back to those religious leaders and he says this also, Matthew 9:13. Then he added, now go and learn the meaning of this scripture. I want you to show mercy, not offer sacrifices. Now that's a punch more than I think we understand. So let's look at it a little closer. Jesus says, now go. First of all, he's like, go, just go. Like, why are you even here, guys? You're not happy, just go, man. You're upset by what you're seeing. You're making everyone else upset by how you're handling that. Just go. Everyone, like, why do people insist on being someplace with their nose in something that makes them mad all the time? Why is it human nature do that? I'm just bothered by this. I'm gonna get, just go away. Just walk away, Jack, you know? So Jesus is like, guys, go and learn the meaning of this scripture. Now that's an insult to them. You know why? Because they know the meaning of the scripture. Hello? We know the scriptures. We read the scriptures. We memorize the scriptures. We study the scriptures. We teach the scriptures. What do you mean, learn the meaning of the scriptures? We know what the scriptures mean. And Jesus is like, no, you don't. You have some verses, because anyone, we've already seen this in the Gospels. We'll say it 100 times more. Anyone can find a verse or 10 to cherry pick here and there throughout the whole Bible to support anything we wanted to support. And so Jesus says, you guys got a verse, but you don't have a point. You missed your point. So here's the thing I want you to do. I want you to go back and I want you to learn the meaning of the scripture. And he quotes them a scripture from the book of Hosea in their Old Testament. He says, I want you to show mercy, not offer sacrifices. What does that mean? Not offering sacrifices. Sacrifices were what they would do to make things up to God where they came short. Remember I said earlier that they believed that they were better than others, that if God grades on a curve, they were probably the best in the class? But even those who believed they were the best in the class knew that they didn't get a perfect score. And if those of you who really care about getting a perfect score want to make up your missed questions, you go to the teacher and say, can I do a makeup test or extra credit questions so I can get my score back up to perfect because I want to have a perfect score. And the religious people of that day tried to be better than others, but where they knew they came short, they could go to the temple and offer sacrifices. It's kind of a makeup work to make them fully right with God. If I do my best and then I offer sacrifices, it rounds me back up and God is happy. And Jesus is like, no, he's not. And the Old Testament said this many times, but here's Jesus making it plain. He's saying, God wants you to treat people right more than he wants you to run around and follow your religious trappings and your religious systems. The word show mercy in the Hebrew, where it's translated from, actually can translate show love. He says, I want you to love people. I want you to show mercy. I want you to be right towards people. You want to impress God? Don't show me your religion. Show me how you treat people. See, this is where it's tricky for you and me. It's tricky because there's a lot of people in general. Forget religion for just a moment. There's a lot of people in general. We like our systems and our structure. It makes us feel secure. Some people, we like lists, and we like metrics, and we like boundaries, and we like to know how to interact with everything. And then we know what we're supposed to do and how to do it just right, and we can excel. We can even stand out. Some people are just wired that way. Some of you are wired that way, right? I know the system. I know what to do. I can follow it. I feel safe and secure in it. We're almost on the spectrum in some way with ourselves, with how we feel safety in that structure. Then there's other people who are very free-spirited, and you're like, I don't know what to do with that guy. But anyhow, religion in general attracts the structure people, doesn't it? Religion just attracts us so fast because it gives us a framework. It's very safe. It's like, if I just do this and do that and don't do that, and here's a list, and here's the things I follow, and here's the boundaries, and I feel good, I feel accomplished, I feel I can measure something, I feel safe. And people who don't fit that they cause angst. And so we want our systems to kind of keep them at arm's length sometimes. Otherwise, we get fearful. Or we get angry because it bothers us. Does it fit our categories? It's natural for humans to be that way. Christianity was never supposed to be another religion. Jesus came to break up religion and give a relationship. But of course, leave it to us for 2,000 years to turn it into a religion. But we like it to our structure. We like that safety. And so then we end up marginalizing people and things that don't fit, that cause us angst because it's messy and we don't like messy. And Jesus is saying, I know what you're wanting, but I want you to go love people and show some mercy. I want you to treat people right. And then he adds this statement. He says, for I have come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners. What's he saying? He's saying, listen, if you think you're all set, you don't need me. I would love to. If you just realize that you need me, I'm here for everybody, religious or not. But if you don't think you do, then what can I do? But I'm here for anyone who knows they're a sinner. Come on in. Jump on in. The water's fine. It'll be great. If Jesus was advertising in the local Jerusalem Gazette paper, he would probably have an advertisement that read something like this. Followers wanted, only sinners need apply. Right? Followers wanted, only sinners need apply. That's the message. And that's open, that's comforting to all of us today. Again, where we struggle here, it's not the idea that sinners can apply, it's that certain kinds of sinners can apply. Because not them, not that group. I mean, sinners can apply, but not disreputable sinners, you know. So that's where we struggle. So I want to take a couple minutes and say this to you, and I'm going to just needle us a little bit. I hope that you'll see the perspective of Jesus and be better. Hope that we feel the comfort of the Matthew's crowd, that know that God loves you and likes you and wants you with him. But let me challenge us with where we struggle with our categories of people that we consider the disreputables or whatever you want to say. You say, well, Arlen, what are you referring to? You tell me. Whatever you're afraid I'm referring to, yes. Okay? Whatever your worst paranoia of what I might be meaning, yes. Here's what I want to say. There's a danger here. It's a caution. There's a difference between being a fan and being a follower of anything. So there's a difference between being a fan and being a follower of Jesus. Now, in case you think you know where I'm going, listen. All of us probably, I know I am a fan of this story. I'm a fan of what Jesus did here. Even if I'm a self-righteous person, I like the story because self-righteous people don't like other types of self-righteous people, you know? Like they're jerks, you know? So when Jesus puts those guys in their place and helps other people, I'm all good with that. It's easy for all of us to be a fan of the story we read today because it feels good from our vantage point. But are we followers? That's a whole different story. That's a hard model to follow. For example, it's hard because living like Jesus means loving people that look nothing like him. Or should I say, it means loving people that we think, in our opinion, look nothing like him. In our belief structure, look nothing like him. How do you do that? It's easy to be a fan. It's hard to be a follower. I'll tell you why. Because being a follower of Jesus means we also must be radically inclusive. And those words alone bother some of us. As humans, as religious people globally. Oh, I'm afraid you were, like, if you're radically inclusive, if you be careful, you'll say that because that might crack the door open for X, Y, and Z. Exactly. Are we a fan or are we a follower? Let me just say it this way. If you haven't, I'm needling all of us, myself and all of us today. If you haven't loved people so much that they say you've gone too far, then you haven't loved like Jesus did. Can I make that a little plainer? If you haven't been so radically inclusive and loved people so much that others say you've gone too far, when I say others, I mean religious others. It's always the religious crowd that's gonna say, you can't do that. Oh, no. Oh, we don't go there. And it was the religious crowd, and again, good people. They came to Jesus and they said, we're trying to read the scriptures. We're trying to memorize them and teach them and follow them. We love God. We honor God. We got to get this right. Jesus, you don't do that. You don't do that, they said. And so they're struggling. They're stressed out because Jesus is doing it wrong and they're going to criticize him. And he had to be okay with that. He had to be willing to do things that they said, you should never include them. And so I want to say it again. If you've never been inclusive or loved people so well that religious or other people have said you've gone too far, have we ever been accused of going too far? If we've not been accused of that, we've not yet loved like Jesus did. And that's hard. That's hard. Because for some of us, we are in the seat of the religious people saying, I'm not going to go that far. And for others of us, we're like, well, I don't want to be that way. But you know what? Let's be real. A lot of us are afraid sometimes as Jesus people. We are afraid of getting the dander and the ire of the religious community against us. Because religious people could be rough, the ones who are self-righteous. The self-righteous people could be rough. They can tell you to your face how wrong you are. They can tell you behind your back how wrong you are. They can put on Facebook or social media how terrible. I watch all the time people get on social media who call themselves Christians and just tear down other churches and leaders who they think are getting it wrong viciously as if they're the spawn of Satan themselves because they don't agree with something. And I'm like, if that's how we are, we don't want to be, some of us are like, I want to love more generously. I want to be more open. But I'm afraid if I do that, that those religious people are going to tell me how, they're going to lump me into the bad category. And I don't want them to criticize me. Why are we so afraid of the opinions of people? And why are we so afraid? Why is there a trigger that makes us afraid of what very religiously zealous people might say about us? Why does that matter? Jesus didn't seem to be bothered by it. So until you and I have loved people in such a way and been so open-armed and open-handed in such a way that crowd criticizes us for going too far, we've not yet loved like Jesus did. And it's not fun. It's not fun space. When you lose friends that way, but it's the only place to walk with Jesus. And so I'll give you one last statement. Go ahead. Be known for how well you love, not how right you are. Now, I was poking at us pretty hard, so let me just try and ease up a little bit and come alongside of those of us who really draw security from the rules. We draw security from being right. Let me just say this to you. I get it. I am a classic get it right kind of guy. I want to be right. We all want to be right. We all think we are right. Otherwise, we would not be it. But some people think they're right, but they're never, you can't question me. They're just going to justify themselves. Many of us, we are willing to say, am I right? I'm going to question it. I'm going to try and figure out what I need to do to grow. I want to get it right. Can I be honest? My whole life has been aimed at trying to get it right. Michelle and I could talk about this the other day on a walk we had together. We have spent our whole life since we were young, raised in a church world where we were wanting to be right and get it right. And do what we were taught and follow the way and don't do what we're not supposed to do and do what we're supposed to. And honestly, it's made us, you know, it's aimed our whole lives in what we've done and not done and what we're doing with our lives to this day. If you ever play a game of never have I ever with us, you'd raise your eyebrow at how boring we are. Because we've wanted to get it right our whole lives, and I still do because I want to be right. But I don't want to be known for being right. I want to be known for how well I love. If my life is over tomorrow, or someone is having a time to remember me when I'm still alive, I don't want my wife's story to be, oh yeah, my husband, yeah, he sure was right. I want her story to be, man, he sure loved me well, right? I want my kids someday to say, oh dad, yeah, you know, he's pretty right. I want them to say, dad, he loved us no matter what. He was always in our corner. The arms wide open, accepted us and stood with us. He was right. You know, you see, but I want to be right. You can write people right out of your life. You can write relationships right out the door. I don't want to be known by my church as, well, pastor sure got things right. I'd rather them say, he loved us well. He wasn't always right. I'd always agree with them, but he loved us well. I'd rather have that. I want the community I live in to not say, oh, the Arlen, that's the guy, he's pretty much right. I want them to say, that guy loved this town. He got involved in our schools, involved in our systems, and he was plugged in, and he sure loved our community. That's what I want. I want our church to be a church. I don't want anyone in this town to say, oh, Lighthouse Church? Huh, those people, well, they're pretty right, or they sure think they're pretty right. I'll tell you, they're worried about being right. I want this town to say, Lighthouse Church, that church loves our community and cares about other people. See, folks, listen, it's okay to want to be right. It's a terrible thing to be known for. I would argue that Jesus was right, but he was known for how well he loved, and he was criticized for how well he loved. And the closer we get to him, the more we will be like that. And that's what I want us to be known for today. And so, I'll leave it at that because I'm talking too much. But I hope that we can relate to all sides of a story today. That if you're here and you wonder if Jesus showed up and he knows you more than anyone else does, if you would feel like you needed to get out of the room because you wouldn't be welcome with him, Jesus would love you. He likes you. He would like you. He does like you. But if you saw him in person, you'd be surprised how much he'd smile and say, let's do this together. And if you're a religious person and you really value your structure and systems and opinions about the world around you, are we trying to follow a system or just love people really well? And are we willing to take it on the chin from other righteous people because we love too well and too broadly and pay a price for doing so? And if we're going to be like Jesus, we must. And I say these things knowing that I did not say this last hour. I need to stop talking, but I'm going to say this anyhow before I'm done. Because I've been doing this job for way too long. In fact, I've been a pastor for 26 years. I learned something early in my ministry when I was raised in a very certain, strict kind of home and in church environment. And I kind of shook that up by making some transitionary models to being more community-minded and less traditionally expected. I learned something that I could prep, I can preach sermons to prep everybody with the concepts of how we're supposed to do things right according to the gospel, but it takes doing an actual thing that's got real details to it. Like, oh, I like the concept, but you can't do that. It's just a concept until it becomes real. And I realize that preaching what I'm saying today is a passion subject for me. But I also realize that there could come circumstances in our way where suddenly doing what we're preaching about today can cause people that were agreeing with the concept to get suddenly very upset because we dared to go there and dared to love here and dared to embrace there and dared to serve here when it actually gets real and practical. And I've watched myself lose friends over the years for doing that. But I'm going to just be very honest with you. I cannot be right, which I want to be, and not prioritize what Jesus does. And that is to love so broadly that it's a price worth paying amongst those who would be most condemning of doing so. We've got to get this right. We've got to love well. We've got to challenge ourselves way outside the safety of our constructs to be like Jesus.